Thank you very much for the introduction and for the invitation to be here. I'm honoured to be here at the Männertagung and to have the chance to speak to you, and I hope to learn from you over the next 2 days, because as the speakers have already indicated, knowledge and practice in this area depend above all on exchange among people with different experiences, different knowledge, coming from different positions in the gender order. So I hope we will have an active exchange during the next 2 days. And I hope to start this with, a reflection on the field of knowledge about men and masculinities in gender terms, and to talk a little about how that field has changed, what the challenges in it have been, and how we might begin to both apply and reconsider concepts such as the concept of hegemonic masculinity. So I want to start with the field of research, the Männerforschung as a field of knowledge. In its modern form, in its contemporary form, the field of research about masculinities is perhaps 25 or 30 years old, fairly recent. It took its modern form largely under the impulse of the new feminism, of the women's liberation movement of the 1970s, to some also extent also as a result of impulses and critiques coming from the gay liberation movement, which should not be forgotten. These movements raised problems about the situation of men, the practices of men, the hierarchies of gender and sexuality, and posed to intellectuals, to researchers, the problem of describing and analysing the social relations that placed people in different positions in relation to gender and sexuality. So in the 1980s, this impulse turned into a research field. Some of the very early and interesting work came from researchers in Europe. One excellent example is Sigrid Metz-Gürkel and Ulla Müller's book, Der Mann, from 1985, one of the pioneering works in the field. And that was part of a genre of work, including my early research in Australia, research by people like Michael Messner in the United States, and colleagues in Britain, New Zealand as well, which described existing patterns of masculinity and tried to build up some explanatory ideas. In the 1990s, this research field deepened with a variety of research methods and spread with more and more countries being represented in the building up of knowledge. We can now say, I think, that this is a mature scientific field. If you look in the electronic databases, such as the Web of Science, and scan for scientific publications with the word masculinity or masculinities in the title or the abstract, you will find something like 4,000 scientific publications on this topic over the last 20 years. There are now 5 or 6 scientific journals which publish research in this area, and there are congresses, conferences in many countries in which the results of this research are circulated and examined. And as I will say in a moment, one of the really important developments has been that the knowledge accumulated by researchers in this ethnographic or descriptive moment of research have been applied in a number of areas of applied social practice, in education, for instance, in the education of boys, to some extent also in the education of girls, in health, social work, as we have already heard, in anti-violence work, concerned with the reduction of domestic violence, rape, and indeed violence between men, because there is a dimension of masculinity politics in patterns of violence between men as well as between men and women. Now, as the knowledge from this research has built up, a number of factual conclusions, a number of implications of the research became clear, indeed quite early. The first and perhaps still the most important conclusion of the research is that there's not just one masculinity in the world, but there are many. There are many different ways, different socially organized ways in which someone can be a man. And those differences exist between different cultures. So the anthropologists have documented very different patterns of the construction of masculinity, for instance, in indigenous communities in Papua New Guinea, near Australia. But also within the same society, there are multiple masculinities. And this is dramatically illustrated by a research project in Peru by our colleague Norma Fulea from Peru. The title reads in Spanish, Masculine Identities. And in this ethnographic study, Norma documented different constructions of masculinity between upper class and working class men in Peru, different constructions of masculinity in the city and in the countryside, in among rural men. And for once, the cover of the book reflects the content. I like this image, and I sometimes use this in teaching to make the point of the multiplicity of forms of masculinity, the plurality of masculinities. But plurality doesn't mean that there's a masculinity here, a masculinity there, a masculinity there, and one can come along and choose a lifestyle like getting dishes from a smorgasbord. We also know, it's also an important finding of the research, that these masculinities have definite relations to each other. They exist in hierarchies through centrality, marginalization, sometimes violence and oppression, sometimes a degree simply of difference in recognition. So the patterns of masculine hierarchy are also a widespread conclusion from the empirical research. And then, of course, we have to ask why this is so and connect the empirical details in the lives of men with the larger structure of gender relations, with the structure of gender that I call the gender order of the society as a whole. And that's those three points, plurality, hierarchy, and relation to the gender order as a whole, are the essence of the concept of hegemonic masculinity. Those are the points which we had in mind in formulating that concept. So I think it's important to recognize that hegemony does not necessarily mean violence. There is a common misinterpretation, which I think you find particularly in American writing about masculinity, which sees hegemonic masculinity as a toxic masculinity associated with violence, brutality, and direct domination. And that's not necessarily true. As Ellie remarked in her introductory words today, hegemony requires a degree of consent. Hegemony is about cultural authority and power, which requires a certain amount of consent from the subordinated groups. And that is also true of gender relations as it is of class relations. So that when we are analyzing hegemony, as using the concept of hegemony as an organizing concept, we're analyzing cultural relations, authority, and consent, as well as power, domination, and perhaps violence. Okay, I remarked that one of the important developments in this field was the spread of argument, ideas, and information from the field of research into fields of applied practice. So I want now to say a few words about the development of practical work around men and masculinities. I've been involved in various ways in the health field. I was one of the people who did early research on AIDS prevention in Australia. And I've been concerned more recently with the attempt to re-theorize gender relations in the health field. So I've been interested in the way that when the concept of men's health as an applied field of knowledge began to emerge, it originally developed as the notion of a kind of gender dichotomy. There was already an area of women's health debate and practice. And in some areas, some places, including Australia, men's health was sort of added as a separate but exactly symmetrical field. So there were women and there were men, and we would have women's health and we would have men's health. In fact, that approach led to a lot of bad policy making. It tended to ignore the whole issue of the pattern of relationships among men and women, relationships between boys and girls in youth. And it tended to an essentialized homogenizing concept of men and their health problems. I'm pleased to see that in recent years, a considerably more sophisticated approach to questions about men's health has been emerging, in which a relational approach to gender and a much more sophisticated approach to masculinity is present. An excellent example of this is the work by an ethnographer, Matthew Gutmann, one of the best ethnographers of masculinity, who has published this book, which I really strongly recommend to anyone interested in men's health issues, about the dilemmas of men's sexual health in Mexico under neoliberal rule. And Mexico's a long way away, and they speak another language there, and many of the men are in poverty. But in a sense, that's the point, that here we have a very different configuration of relationships in which we can see dynamic processes in which men are active in negotiating very difficult issues about reproductive health, about infection, about poverty, about access to public health services, all of those kinds of things interwoven with a very sophisticated account of how masculinities are constructed and how men's practices play out in the different arenas of the family, the workplace, and public spaces. Really excellent study and an example of the better research on masculinity and health that is now developing. I have had a job recently as a professor of education, so I'm also interested in the development of educational discourses about boys, masculinity, and education. And there again, we see this problem that often when teachers or education policy makers or parents groups think, okay, we need to think about the education of boys as a gender issue, there's a tendency to think dichotomously, to think about boys here and girls there. It's the approach that I call the boys in a box approach to education. You know, boys are like this and they're all the same and they all have a different kind of brain and so we need a different kind of education for them. In fact, that's scientifically wrong. Boys and girls don't have different learning styles. They both have the same range of mental and emotional capacities. And their educational needs, in fact, are very similar. And yet there are some boys who are having real difficulties in school, for whom the education system does not work well, and for whom we need a sophisticated analysis of gender issues, of problems of masculinity in education. So again, a more relational, a more subtle and a more indeed intelligent approach to education is needed. The third applied area I want to mention is about violence, gender-based violence. There is now a lot of evidence that gender-based violence, that levels of interpersonal violence are linked with particular patterns of masculinity. Some of you will know the recent European Union-sponsored research on gender-based violence and the attempt to coordinate the legal framework across the different countries of the European Union. And in that project, there is a great deal of evidence. Sorry, this is not the title of that project. I'm a little ahead of myself. In that project, there is a lot of evidence, statistical evidence, of the connections between certain masculinity patterns and levels of violence. But knowing a statistical connection is not knowing what to do about it. So we need, as well as the very descriptive research, we also need to understand the dynamics of violence in gender terms, the actual mechanisms and situations in which violence is likely to be a consequence. And there is indeed a very creative body of work in criminology, associated with researchers like James Messerschmidt in the United States, Stephen Thompson in Australia, which has been tracing the ways in which violence can be an enactment of gender politics among men, very closely connected, not necessarily with existing patterns of hegemonic masculinity, but with disturbances of hegemonic masculinity and challenges to hegemonic masculinity. So again, we need to take an active, dynamic approach to understanding, and then we begin to get the kind of knowledge which can be put into practice in anti-violence programs. And this is my slide, which is the cover of a very interesting book from India, where there is an active program of debate about issues of men and masculinities, and in particular, a very active set of programs and debates around the reduction of gender-based violence. Now, in any field of knowledge and practice, we're likely to face challenges. And there certainly have been significant challenges to this field of masculinity research and masculinity practice. I want to mention three that we need to think about and that will be in your minds during this conference. One is the political challenge to this field that comes from the political right. We have right-wing politicians in Australia too, you will be comforted to learn. And indeed, when I got my very first grant to do research about masculinity way back in the 1980s, even before I had begun the research. The research grant was attacked by right-wing politicians in the National Parliament as a waste of public money. So it happens with us as well, and I'm conscious of the presence of this kind of politics in the German-speaking countries as researched by Thomas Gesterkamp. With us, it's often connected with a kind of pop psychology, the kind of psychology that you read in airport bookshops that tell us, you know, women are from, what is it, men are from Mars and women are from Venus. The idea that masculinity is single and fixed and, you know, fixed by the genes, if not by religion. That men, women, you know, are succeeding everywhere, and men are victims now, and poor boys are failing in schools, and really the scene of masculinity is a scene of disaster and horror, which obviously requires political correction. Okay, you know this discourse, I know this discourse. It's pretty well research-free zone, a knowledge-free zone. And to that extent, it's hard to reply to because much of this comes out of emotion, not knowledge, and is mixed up with neoconservative attacks on feminism and attempts to roll back gender equality. But we do have to deal with it in practice. We have to recognize the power of this discourse, and we need, in fact, answers. And I think some of the answer has to be that we offer good knowledge where knowledge is lacking. There have also been interesting challenges to masculinity research from a completely different direction, from post-structural critics who have seen the analysis of masculinity as itself a form of essentialism, that the research, the criticism is that the research tends to treat men as a preformed category, and the preoccupation with masculinity and femininity in effect refers us back to heteronormative assumptions, reproduces in our science the social assumptions about heterosexual marriage as the social paradigm. I think there is some value in this criticism. If we look, for instance, at a well-known type of image in a magazine that I'm sure all of you have seen and perhaps read on railway stations. I have bought this magazine on a railway station in Germany, though this particular issue I bought in an airport in Chile. You will notice that it's in Spanish. It now circulates globally. And it constructs a certain image of the ideal male body and embeds certain assumptions about where that body is placed in social relations, and in particular the heterosexuality of the assumption. So in this issue of the magazine, we are taught 69 sexual secrets that men must know in order to get good sex with women. So there is a heterosexual framing of a lot of the public imagery about masculinity, even though, and note the ambivalence, the image is actually one that also circulates in gay media. And often men's health is hardly distinguishable from certain kinds of gay pornography, strange to tell. So these kinds of issues have been opened up in a very interesting way by post-structuralist analysis, though post-structuralism also has serious limits, especially when we try to apply its ideas in areas of practice such as education and social work. The third challenge to the field is the one that I have paid most attention to and think ultimately is the most important. This is the challenge from the Global South. Most of the scientific discourse about masculinity has been built up in the Global North or in the very rich parts of the periphery, global periphery such as Australia and New Zealand. But most men in the world live in the Global South, in Africa, Latin America, South Asia, East Asia. That's where the majority of men in the world are. And it's therefore extremely important that a body of research and theoretical work is also building up in regions outside the global metropole. And I have already mentioned some of that, and I want to reinforce this point. Some of the most creative, important, and interesting research on men and masculinities now comes from the Global South. And we need to know about this, get in touch with it, and learn from it so that our concepts also are influenced by this. For instance, the most sustained single program of research on masculinities anywhere in the world has been done in Chile, led by José Olavarría, a colleague, a very interesting researcher. Unfortunately, very little of his work is available in any language except Spanish, but if you do speak Spanish or can access it that way, José Olavarría's work is really quite important for the field. India, I've mentioned. Here we have an image of working class men in India in a moment of social conflict around documentation. And there's also wonderful research about masculinity that has been done and is being done in South Africa. South Africa, you know, one of the most unequal countries in the world, a country that's been through the trauma of apartheid and now the attempt to create gender equity in conditions of neoliberal development, all of that. And yet there's magnificent research about masculinity coming out of South Africa. That's an example. I think this is probably the best collection. You know, there are many books that are collections of studies of men and masculinity. This is probably the best single collection of research on masculinity I have ever seen. And I'm being a little enthusiastic about this because I want to encourage you, whatever the difficulties of language, distance, and access, go looking for work from the Global South. There's lots of it there. Some of it you can access electronically. Some of it we have to encourage the libraries to get. Some of it is exceptionally good, and all of it is useful in getting beyond a simply local vision of issues about men and masculinity. And that's something we now really have to do. So let me turn now to this question of globalization and how we think about and study masculinities, including masculinities here, but think about them in a global context, thinking masculinity on a world scale. Now, there are several points I want to make about this. The first is that reading writers from the Global South can help us to see masculinities differently, simply because they are coming from a different cultural and historical context and are facing differently shaped dilemmas. This is an approach that I have called Southern Theory. This is actually a book which I can recommend you read. It's a good Christmas present. But there are other people besides me who are doing this, I hasten to add. But in that book, you will find an account of a writer from Iran called Ali Ahmad. Excuse my bad pronunciation of Farsi. And this is Ali Ahmad. No longer with us, a very interesting writer. Some of his short stories have been translated into English, and there may even be some of his work translated into German. He wrote from the 1940s to the 1970s, is that generation. And in the early 1960s, he wrote a very funny and very penetrating, very intelligent critique of neocolonial Iranian society as it existed then in the days of the Cold War. The book is called in Farsi, Rabzadegi, and the rough translation of that is West Toxication, being intoxicated with the West. And part of his argument is a very interesting, so to speak, social anatomy of middle-class masculinity in Iran, in which he explores themes of alienation and inauthenticity in the context of global power. Because the problem for him is that the middle class in Iran is a kind of rootless community of men who acquire power because of their relationship to global wealth and power, to the international economy, but don't have firm cultural and social roots in their own society. So he has this very nice phrase for middle-class masculinity in that context of globalization. He calls these men, or such a man, a donkey in a lion's skin. A donkey in a lion's skin, an inauthentic man with the trappings of masculine authority. And that's an interesting image for thinking about the impact of globalization on middle-class men, as distinct from working class. So that's the first thing I want to suggest, that we can find in writers from the global south different ways of thinking about masculinity, different starting points, which can trigger off really quite creative thinking. The second thing we need to do, the second thing that thinking globally will do for us, is to think about the world as a gender arena. And that's actually not often done in the globalization literature. The globalization literature tends to be gender-free, actually, or to think of globalization as a matter of capital, economics, states, political economy, and then there's some kind of gender impact of all of this. But I do argue, that globalization is gendered from the start, just as global imperialism was a gendered process. And the global economy is a very strongly gendered economy. Consider, for instance, the transfer of manufacturing from high-wage countries, like countries of Central and Northern Europe, to low-wage countries like China, Southeast Asia, Mexico. This is a factory which is involved in this neoliberal transfer of manufacturing. It's in northern Mexico, in the borderlands there, and these factories are called maquiladoras. And you're looking at a workforce of women. This is manufacturing cheap clothing for the United States market, just over the border to the north. They're owned by men, they're controlled by men, they're run by men, but the workforce itself, a very poorly paid workforce, is women. And that's a characteristic division of labor, meant the creation of a characteristic division of labor in the global economy. On the other hand, another important part of the global economy is mining in the global periphery. You know, silver from here, coal from Australia, gold from South Africa, precious metals from Central Africa, and so forth. This is also a very important part of a globalized economy. And this too creates a gendered workforce, but it's a masculinized workforce. This is a picture of the gold mines in South Africa, far underground, deep underground, where you have black men doing the laboring and white men, as you see on the right-hand side of this underground picture, white men doing the management, doing the supervision. And that's very characteristic of the mining economy, of plantation economies, agricultural export economies, pastoralism in South America and the South Pacific, and so forth. So the global economy is a strongly gendered place, and that's gives, if you like, the gendered dimension to the precarious labour, which is also very characteristic of the new transnational labour force. Now, migration, new labour conditions, precarious labour, plus post-colonial violence, plus the drug trade, plus sometimes the human trade, that can produce very toxic situations in the globalized world. And I want to mention one of it as one example, as something for us to think about. This is another picture from northern Mexico in the desert just outside the city of Juarez, Ciudad Juarez. This is known, this city is known now as the murder capital of the world. It's an extraordinarily violent place. And over the last 20 years, there have been a very large number of killings of women, mostly young women, sometimes girls, who have been abducted, raped, tortured, and murdered, and their bodies dumped in the desert or in vacant blocks. So hundreds and hundreds of these murders have occurred in this one city in 2 decades. It has reached the point where Mexican activists talk about femicide. It's as if there's a war, a gender war going on. And this is how the women of Juarez City memorialize their daughters, the dead young women. And these pink crosses have become an international symbol because there is now an international support movement to try to stop the violence and to memorialize the women who have lost their lives there. Now, in that situation, we cannot really speak of hegemonic masculinity. This is a situation of such social disorder and brutality, it's not really a question of hegemony. It's a question of gender-based violence and domination, all right, but it's a kind of limiting case, if you like, where the concept of hegemony is not really the guiding concept. But in other arenas, the concept of hegemony really is useful because there are other actors in the global economy who do have authority and centrality. And this is particularly the managers of transnational corporations. This is an image that I also use in teaching a lot. It's one of my very favorite images. It comes from a US business magazine, and it's based on an interview with a manager in transnational business who did this, and this really does represent the way these men, I've interviewed a number of them in the course of research projects, they really do think they hold up the world, that they're responsible for the creation of wealth, for the existence of the international economy. It's a nice symbolic. Now, this is an arena in which masculinity is undoubtedly predominant. 98% of the top executives of big transnational corporations are men. It's practically a masculine monopoly. And the very little bit of research that's been done about the way of life in transnational management shows that this statistic, you know, reflects a strongly embedded masculine culture at the top levels of large businesses. So if we're looking for the most powerful group of men in the world, where hegemony might be somehow concentrated in a transnational sense, these are really the people that we're looking at. We don't yet know very much about them from a research point of view, but there are some studies, we are beginning to build up a picture of this part of society. Okay. Hegemonic masculinity, then, I suggest, is a concept that has been useful in organizing knowledge in the arena of Männerforschung for some time. And it's a concept that continues to be of interest. There are some hundreds of scientific papers that concern this concept. It's the subject of debate in continuing debate in journals. Some of you may know this journal just came out last, this issue just came out last year. The journal is Erwägen, Wissen, Ethik, and it's a special issue about hegemonic masculinity and changes in it, with the lead article by Michael Meuser, whose work I'm sure many of you will know. Now, the concept is constantly under debate. It's not a fixed concept. It's open to challenge and ought to be open to challenge, as all scientific concepts should be. The concept of hegemony itself refers to a situation, a moment, in which social relations are configured in a particular way to lead to power and authority for some groups, subordination or marginalization for others. That's a situation. It can change. Indeed, we could argue it must change. Patterns of hegemony must change in history. And we know some of the ways that patterns of hegemony change. We know some of the reasons for change. One is pressure from women. When women, you know, change their position in the world or place demands upon men, men are required to respond, sometimes with anger and rejection, sometimes with acceptance, sometimes with compromise. We're now familiar with all of this. Economic change can result in changes of hegemony, and I've just been talking about that with the globalization of the world economy, creating dire, bad situations for some groups of men and women in places like Juarez, and creating unprecedented power and authority for other groups of men, particularly those privileged by the global economic system. Geopolitics may also create changes in hegemony. The clash of nations, warfare, fighting, the security services, these kinds of things also may influence the way power plays out in gender relations. And finally, changes in men's consciousness, because men are not passive in gender relations. Men also formulate purposes and can formulate intentions to change gender relations. So men also are agents in the renegotiation of hegemony, in the changes of hegemony in gender relations. Now, we know those forces that are at play, and we can expect patterns of hegemony to change, but we cannot expect them to change overnight. They do not, they're not this way today and that way tomorrow. These patterns, hegemonic masculinities and subordinated and marginalized masculinities, are embedded in powerful structures of social relations. I mean, gender is a large-scale, powerful, deeply entrenched system of social relations and meanings and identities. It's not something light as a feather which will float away on the next breeze. We're dealing with serious, difficult, and deeply embedded patterns here. So we need also to think about the institutions in which gender relations are embedded. And these can be powerful and they can develop in ways we don't necessarily like. Here's an image, recent image from the media in Australia to illustrate this. We're familiar with the idea that competitive sports are an important arena for the making of masculinities. and indeed for defining hegemonic masculinity as the form of masculinity which is physically fit, capable of dominating other men's bodies, competitive, strong, invulnerable, all of these kinds of things. Okay, as represented by the professional footballer above all. And this is a famous professional footballer in Australia, in my hometown of Sydney, where the dominant code of football is rugby league, which is a particularly violent and brutal version of football in which bodies are hitting into each other all the time. And there's actually quite a lot of blood and injury around at the end of a week's play. Now, a generation ago, we could have shown a picture of footballers and said, yes, that's a recreational form of masculinity. That's a sort of something marginal to the main story about masculinity, which is in the workplace and the home, because football is entertainment and recreation. But now, football is business. This is what we're seeing here is not just a fit and handsome young man. We're seeing the front person for a big corporation, which gets millions and millions and millions of dollars of advertising revenue in from these displays of male bodies in conflict, and which sort of here symbolizes the embedding of masculinities in a larger structure of gender relations, because there is a role for women. But what is the role for women in this arena of display? Okay, it's being the cheerleader. It's being the... In fact, there is a lot of rape and sexual abuse around professional rugby league. There's a scandal a week last year around this code. And what you've got here, in fact, is a corporate incitement of a certain kind of gender hierarchy. This is a deliberate display organized by corporate capital of a certain, I think, very toxic pattern of gender relations. And that kind of production of gender hierarchy is going on through large and powerful organizations. I mean, this is not just a neighborhood event. This is now the product of mainstream corporate power. So we need also to think about this, to think about the institutional bases of gender hierarchy and gender inequality and gender injustice. We need to think of the way I've mentioned, as Ellie mentioned, that hegemony always implies a certain amount of consent on the part of the subordinated groups. So what we are seeing here for the young women is the orchestration of a certain kind of consent to being regarded as sex objects, to being marginalized by men, because many young women in Sydney admire that position and desire a relationship with the footballers and enact that kind of emphasized but subordinated femininity. So the issue of consent and how it's produced and how it can be challenged is really central to what we're concerned with in this conference. And sometimes, you know, when I see this kind of thing, I despair. And I think, okay, gender justice is not going to be achieved in my lifetime, where once I thought it was, maybe not ever. But that's wrong. I mean, that's a moment of despair. It's not my rational conclusion. Gender justice is possible. It always was possible, even at earlier moments of social development, and it continues to be possible now. But it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen next week. It's not going to happen next year. It doesn't happen. It's not the kind of thing that happens in a blinding flash. It involves the remaking of a whole structure of social relations, culture, identities, and personal life. That's a long-term task. Gender justice to me is something that is built step by step, sometimes with big, quick gains, sometimes with very small gains, hard won, and sometimes two steps back. for the one step forward. We have to be prepared to face this if we are serious about gender justice. And facing that is only possible. I despair as an individual, but when I'm with other people collaborating, working together on gender issues, I have optimism. Working together, working collectively, is the only way that we are going to take those steps forward. And that centrally means joint action between men and women, which is why I'm very pleased at the gender balance in this conference. This seems to me a hopeful sign of potential cooperation in this long and difficult process. But in this process, we can also draw confidence as well as specific learning from the fact that this is happening globally. We are not alone in this struggling with gender inequality and attempt to achieve gender justice. So I want to end, in fact, with an example from my own experience of the hopefulness of international collaboration around gender justice. Some 6 or 7 years ago, I was involved in work with the United Nations in formulating documents about the role of men and boys in achieving gender equality. And we drew together people, activists, researchers, and policymakers from all over the world into a policy process, which actually produced a policy document adopted by the United Nations back in 2004, which is the first detailed policy statement of men and boys as positive agents in achieving gender equality. And this booklet, which you can get for free from the United Nations, and indeed you can download online, brings together not only that document and that experience, but many practical examples of gender equality work in many different parts of the world, the global south, the global north, and transnational arenas too, as a resource. Not only giving particular examples, I think, but also suggesting to people how much connection there can be between such projects, such research, and such activism in different parts of the world. So there really is a worldwide movement around these issues. We are not alone. The task is huge, the task is difficult, but we are not isolated in our concern with these issues. And that, above all, is what gives me hope for the future. Thank you.